October 22nd, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are colleagues Jim Flink and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, remembering legendary newspaper editor, The Washington Post, Ben Bradley. Fears over Ebola lead several journalism schools across the country to cancel appearances from reporters and editors recently in West Africa. And CNN says it's considering ending its sponsorship of the National Association of Black Journalists after the group's leadership voices concern about the news organization's workplace culture. We've got a lot more, hopefully, that we're going to get to as well, but I want to start with Ferguson. There's a bit of a new normal in the St. Louis suburb, where there have been protests in the streets for more than 70 days. For the most part, things have quieted down a bit from the violence we saw in early August. But with a leak to the New York Times this weekend that evidence presented to the grand jury seems to back Officer Darren Wilson's account of what happened, the potential exists for it to become a tinderbox once again. Yesterday, Governor Jay Nixon announced what he says is the next step in preventing Ferguson from happening again, creating a commission to study the social and economic conditions that led to Michael Brown's death, to address the concerns, and to offer recommendations on how to make this area a better one to live in.
What now? What will we do in this moment while the whole world is watching? What will we do to move forward after 73 days of civil unrest? Legitimate issues have been raised by thoughtful voices on all sides. Shouting past one another will not move us to where we need to go. Outsiders eager to grab the national spotlight and push their own agendas do not have the best interests of this community, this state, or our nation at heart. That is why today I'm announcing the creation of the Ferguson Commission. I'm asking for your help in identifying individuals in this region to serve on this important commission.
So this commission isn't likely to be formed until sometime next month. Nixon saying that at this point he's looking for nominations of people who may be able to serve on it. That story in the New York Times this weekend laid out what looks to be evidence that could show there won't be an indictment coming down the line.
Well, we don't know about that yet.
We don't know about that yet.
Because there could be other evidence that, you know, shows that there could be an indictment. It may not be the indictment that people were hoping for, or it could be a no bill. We don't know where that's going to go. But I do think that this was an effort by Nixon to get out in front of that, to be proactive, because when the Ferguson situation first erupted, he was reacting to what was going on. So, I mean, in a way, I have to commend him for that. But those who are saying that that's the reason why he's doing it, I think that's one reason. I think another reason is that, you know, this could be Nixon's legacy.
It likely will be.
And it likely will be. And I think he wants to be able to say, hey, I did something that moved these issues forward. Mm-hmm. And I have to commend him for that as well, because there are a lot of other politicians in the state of Missouri and nationally who've ran away from this and didn't want to deal with it. But he's dealing with it head on, so I do have to commend him for that.
Well, but let's be clear about something. This is not a Ferguson, Missouri issue alone. This is a St. Louis, Missouri issue. You could say that this is an issue in many cities across the country. And so in the respect that there would be a commission appointed to address the issues in Ferguson, and they are deep-seated and long-running, that is going to be difficult to achieve tangible, marked results. The other thing is that all of St. Louis needs to look at this as a reflection of it as well, and that this incident, these 73 days of civil unrest, should be sparking conversations in every corner of that community about awareness, about the kinds of conversations that people are having and who they're having them with, and about day-to-day life in that community and how segregated it continues to be.
Yeah, I think one of the issues with St. Louis, and as Jim said, I mean, this is around the country, but St. Louis is a microcosm of a lot of communities where you aren't having these conversations. And you have to go even further than the conversations. There needs to be some tangible changes that take place, because what's happening in St. Louis is that you have an inner core and a northern part of the city that's one area, and then you have the west and other
south.
Areas
mm-hmm.
and south
mm-hmm.
of St. Louis mm-hmm. that are totally different. And every time that there seems to be a move in a direction to bring St. Louis together as a whole, instead of that happening, you have more and more white flight, more and more schools that are disproportionately economically disparity. And so it's just one of those situations that when they have an opportunity to do something, they really haven't taken advantage of it.
Well, and to one other issue, and that is whether or not this is Governor Jay Nixon's legacy or not. You know, obviously time and history will tell a lot of that, but, you know, particularly with police departments and predominantly white police departments that are serving predominantly African-American or just a diverse population, this also should – there should be subsets of conversations and proactive policies that are being enforced and enabled and adopted to deal with the underlying issues. So it is very simplistic, and I think we all like to put things under simple umbrellas and say, well, you know, the governor should have done this or Ferguson should do this, when we all should look for what is our role to do in this and how do I affect change in my corner of the world. And if everyone in that community isn't doing that, then you have to question how seriously change is going to be adopted.
And in fact, I mean, the media plays a huge role in this because quite often mm-hmm. – they aren't covering the community as a whole. Mm-hmm. They're covering the community in certain ways. And the whole Ferguson issue clearly shows that. I mean, now you're seeing these issues that have been there for a long time out in the open.
Latent.
In some cases,
latent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you show South and West St. Louis County looking one way, and you show North and Central looking another way. And that is a part of the problem as well. So we can't, as a media, we can't just sort of sit on the sidelines and not be a part of those conversations and a part of the policies as well.
Okay, I want to talk about something else that played out on our TV sets this weekend, the coverage of Pumpkin Fest at Keene State University. You may have heard about it. There were dozens of arrests at a street party that turned violent.
This was last night in Keene, New Hampshire. Police in riot gear had to use tear gas to try to disperse rowdy partiers who were allegedly throwing liquor and beer bottles, tearing down street signs, setting fires. Dozens of people were arrested and multiple ambulances were sent to the scene.
I got hit with a Jack Daniels bottle, like across the face. I was in the health center for a little bit, but I left.
It's ridiculous. It's not Pumpkin Fest. I mean, from Rhode Island, we're supposed to have a fun weekend, and this is stupid.
The scenes may not have looked all that different than what we saw in the early days in Ferguson with tear gas and rubber bullets, but there is a difference here. Keene, New Hampshire is a predominantly white upper middle class community. Is it a fair comparison when you talk about the militarization of police forces and how crowds are brought back under control?
Well, I think that what you're seeing is that there are communities in which you have problems in terms of how the police interact with the members of that community. And this sort of transcends race to a certain extent. But I think the differences between what's happening there and what's happening in Ferguson is mm-hmm. that with Ferguson, there's some systemic problems. Mm-hmm. These are issues that revolve not just around the police department, but it also revolves around the court system. It revolves around the criminal justice system as a whole. In Keene, it was just, to me, it just seemed like a party that got out of hand and everyone was expecting it, but they didn't expect it to be this, you know, this hostile.
Well, and we've seen incidents at the University of West Virginia, and we could go on and on. This is almost like the gamification of life. This is like Grand Theft Auto meets an opportunity. I mean that very seriously because I don't know a kid who doesn't know, not all their parents allow him to play Grand Theft Auto, but, and you know, so an opportunity presents itself. And look, for the police department, this is an opportunity to deploy resources and to, frankly, have a real live drill. They train and train and train, and then you get a situation like this, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, our training is coming into play.
I hate
here.
To sound crass, but smoke them if you got them.
And in fact, a very good idea for when something more serious might evolve. And again, to be clear, Ferguson, that is a real issue. That was a tempest that was going to boil over at some point, and there was a situation that happened. This seems much more opportunistic and seems like a bunch of kids who, frankly, don't know the difference between their video game and real life and about what they should be doing when situations like that arise.
And the other issue here is that, you know, they've had problems with this festival for years. I mean, if you go on our Links blog and read the stories that mm-hmm. come out of that, we showed the clip. But if you go and read the stories actually talk about they knew that there was a potential for this to happen, so they were geared up for it. I'm talking about law enforcement. And also, they were promoting this, not just for the community, but for the entire region. Hey, come on down. We're going to have this festival. Well, you know, in a somewhat of a college town, you say, hey, we're going to have a festival.
You're thinking about campus decorations like we might have in Greektown this weekend. Right. Yes. You're not thinking about something developing into some kind of civil unrest.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like things are set up for this to potentially happen. And when it does, the police are going to react in the way in which they're trained.
Okay. Well, we got word last night that legendary Washington Post editor Ben Bradlee died yesterday at his Washington, D.C. home. Bradlee spent more than 26 years at the helm of the Post. The first thing people usually think of when they hear his name is Watergate. Ernest, is that Bradlee's biggest mark on the history of American journalism?
Yes, I would say it's his biggest role that he played. I mean, mm-hmm. he also was instrumental in the Pentagon Papers case that occurred right before, several years before Watergate. But Watergate is what he's going to be remembered for. And out of that came a whole generation of journalists who were trained and basically got into the profession because of what Bradlee and Woodward and Bernstein and others did in that Watergate era.
Journalism has many chapters to tell, whether it be the penny press or whether it be yellow journalism or whatever. You know, I think that Ben Bradlee helped to write a chapter of journalistic history, and you're the historian, not I, but that I think all journalists should look to and be proud of, in the respect that when government failed the people, the journalists stepped into a role and really performed a very valuable function to our society as a whole. And for that, I think he deserves his spot in history. He certainly has been celebrated in film and elsewhere, but I think he definitely left his mark.
And I think one of the things that he really needs to be remembered for is that when Watergate first broke, the Washington Post was the newspaper that,
right.
mm-hmm. that covered Robert. That story. When all the others said, this can't be happening. This is just unbelievable.
Completely unimaginable.
And we can't imagine that the government under the President of the United States would stoop to these levels. And Bradlee allowed his people to continue to follow that story all the way through.
And took a perspective of government as Camelot, if mm-hmm. you'll remember that, mm-hmm. right? And really brought it down to, okay, it's not all that.
Right.
Yeah, well, last week wasn't one of the best for our business. The New York Times laid off 100 from its newsroom. Gannett cut back, including eliminating an entire publication in Knoxville, Tennessee. It's called Metro Pulse. And CNN laid off 150 people and canceled several of its shows, including CNN Money, Sanjay Gupta, MD, and Crossfire. Actually, this is the second time Crossfire's been canceled. So our next topic is related to that. Sort of. See, last week, the National Association of Black Journalists issued a press release citing concern with the atmosphere for African-American journalists working at the cable network. It pointed out several African-American anchors have left the desk or left CNN altogether in the past few years, among them Soledad O'Brien, TJ Holmes, Suzanne Malvo. It pointed out that there are only two African-American executive producers, and Monday, a former writer-producer filed a $5 million discrimination and wrongful termination suit. Well, that was just the first move in a complicated game of gotcha. First, there was a statement that said CNN was dropping its sponsorship of NABJ's annual conference. Then CNN said that that wasn't exactly true, that it was considering dropping it. NABJ's Bob Butler told the Washington Post CNN has basically called him a liar. This is really a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal, but the overall issue mm-hmm. that we have here is the lack of diversity and diverse voices within journalism. And this is something that the industry has been struggling with since 1968. They put a bunch of benchmarks up. They don't meet those benchmarks. They move the deadline a little bit further down the road, or kick the can, as some would say, a little bit further down the road. But all in all, what's happening is that You don't have enough diversity within mainstream media. And now what's happened is that you have a generation of minority journalists who are basically saying, we're going to create our own. And a lot of them have gone into social media. They've created their own voices. They have worked to use the internet and other means by which to create.
The griot being an example of one of those.
I mean, there are a lot of them out there, and a lot of them are doing the job in a lot of these communities that the mainstream media for years have claimed that they wanted to do. I mean, if you look at the Ferguson story, you can look at the Trayvon Martin story, you can go to all of these. It's been those media outlets, the ones that have been created by journalists, African-American journalists and other minority journalists who have left the industry, they've created a place for themselves and they're thriving.
To be fair, this is reflective of what's happening in the larger whole as well. People of various skill sets, people of various perspectives. There are all sorts of things that are shaking out in this rapidly changing landscape in terms of what's happening. And so some of the losses of the job that you started with are very interesting because journalists are having to reinvent themselves. And this is one of the ways I think Ernest nails it on the head that, you know, why seek to get your 3 or 8 or 10% of the pie when if you're committed to covering issues in a certain way and you have the resources to be able to do it, the know-how to be able to do it, and you can devote 100% of your time to whatever it be, whether it be technology, business, whatever it might be, then maybe you turn your focus in that direction. I don't think that in any way explains all of what's going on, but I think it at least explains parts of it.
No, it doesn't explain all that's what's going on. I think also part of it is that within the mainstream media, they're having a problem trying to monetize or continue to monetize their products in the changing environment in which people aren't going to mainstream media to get their news and information. And if they aren't going to get it there, then the advertisers are kind of questioning whether or not they should be spending the money. And they just aren't generating the same kinds of profit. And so they're laying people off. And in laying off those people, it's usually the situation where the last hired is the first fired. And in a lot of those cases, the last hired were minorities.
And the other point is that they aren't the be-all, end-all place that people with a lot of talent necessarily want to end up any longer. And we've talked about that, and we've talked about sort of the brand journalists who are sort of going out on their own, the David Pogues of the world. I think this is all part of that shakeout as well. It used to be that you had the goal that you were going to work at that iconic news organization, and now maybe it doesn't offer all the things that being on your own can.
In the ability to innovate and to go
indeed.
From there.
And I think the other issue here is that you have more and more journalists, not just journalists of color, but journalists in general, who are willing to call out the mainstream media when they feel that they aren't living up to their responsibilities. And one of the things that really, and I think people should go and look at our Links blog because we pointed out a lot of these stories.
Fantastic piece on there, too, about African-American journalist in her late 20s who left the industry entirely because she felt there was so much institutional racism within her newsroom.
Right, right. But another issue that I find even more important is the fact that you have journalism organizations who are laying off people in droves, but then they don't want to talk about it. Even though they go out and they cover national industry who lay off people and they expect to get comments from them. But then when another journalism organization, say, goes to CNN or goes to Gannett.
Or to Bloomberg, which has a policy of not covering itself.
Right, exactly. And says, hey, you know, you laid off all these people. Can we get a comment about it? And they fall back and say, well, to protect the personal interests of the people that we've laid off, we don't want to talk about it. That's a lame excuse that journalists wouldn't accept from someone else. Mm-hmm. So why are they giving those explanations?
Okay, so all of that said about diversity and issues of diversity within newsrooms, let's talk about how Hartford's WFSB introduced its new anchor, Mark Zini. During his first newscast, they ran a 3.5-minute video piece talking about the causes important to him, including fighting homelessness and helping shelter animals. Then it got into Zini's more personal side.
Mark's life is an open book. He recently suffered a health crisis battling with thyroid cancer, and it's a struggle that he shared with viewers in hopes of bringing attention to the disease.
I definitely would rather be there for the community to help them and to do good and to raise awareness. Because time is limited, you know.
He faced that struggle head on and with humor, something he brings to everyday experiences.
I know we've revealed her nickname before on air, and I think she's going to cringe right now, and she's probably yelling, but I call her Hot Pants.
Now, Mark's journey is taking him and his partner of 10 years to here, Connecticut, and WFSB, a new place to call home.
So the 3.5 minute piece really gives you, if you watch the whole thing, and you can get a link to it on our blog, gives you this intimate picture of who this guy is and really helps you connect. But there are some who are out there that are saying this is the first time ever that a TV station in its on-air introduction of station talent has been as overt in pointing out that he has a same-sex partner, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, anchor lives with his wife and three children in the suburbs, mm-hmm. that this is being very much out there and upfront about who he is, how he lives his life. And there's been some discussion about whether that should be or shouldn't. And it was an interesting discussion I've seen. I'd be interested in hearing your take.
Well, you would hope so. I mean, you would hope that if you're going to build your brand around a group of people and say these folks are reflective of your community, they're involved in your community, they're imbued in your community, they are your community, that that it would be a cross-section of folks that do, in fact, represent the community. So I would say you're going to see a lot more of this, I would think.
Yeah, I think it's something that is probably needed, because mm-hmm. what happens is you hire these people in, they're supposed to be reflective of your mm-hmm. community, as mm-hmm. Jim said, and then you see one part of it, but you don't see the other because you're afraid of some backlash that's going to come. I think we're sort of moving away from that era. At least I hope that we're moving away from that era so that you can see these communities reflected in their totality.
Well, and we started this clip about halfway in, and the line that struck me and why I chose to start it there was, Mark's life is an open book, mm-hmm. starting first with illness, which we've seen anchors and people on newscasts talk about all the time, mm-hmm. and then getting into personal mm-hmm. relationships. He's got nothing to hide, and he's wanting you to know everything about who and what is important to him.
Well, and if news organizations are starting conversations that people ought to have about their community, then this would be one discussion that people in a community ought to be talking about, is their relationships, what makes them proud, what makes them happy, what makes them go, you know, those kinds of things. And these are the kinds of conversations that you hope, because news brands are increasingly going to have to build themselves around community as other things start to fall away that they used to just count on. And really, ultimately, that's what they have to be about.
Okay. Well, less than 2 weeks before an election, anything's game, right? Well, let's talk about some developments in the Illinois governor's race that are directly related to the media. The Republican candidate, Bruce Rauner, has captured the endorsements of all of the 8 major state daily newspapers. It should be noted also that Rauner is a one-time investor in the company that owns the Chicago Sun-Times. Interesting, because the paper gave Rauner its stamp of approval after saying it was getting out of the endorsement business after the last election cycle. That's just one issue that we're going to talk about as it relates to this race. Let's first talk about why one of the paper's political reporters has hired a formal federal prosecutor to look into whether Rauner's campaign tried to interfere with his employment. This is complicated to boil down into just a few seconds, so you're going to want to go to our links blog to read the full backstory. But basically, Dave McKinney disappeared from the Sun-Times for several days after the paper ran his piece about Rauner's alleged threat to, quote, bury a female CEO. Rauner had tried to squash the story, claiming McKinney couldn't avoid a conflict of interest given McKinney's marriage to a Democratic strategist. The paper disagreed and printed the story anyway. There are stories all the time that politicians try to squash because they're not happy with how they may be portrayed in that. But this one feels like it's a big ball of worms given the candidate's financial interest in the paper as well.
Well, I mean, it's Illinois. This is Illinois politics.
Fair enough.
I mean,
Interestingly enough, the former federal prosecutor is Patrick Collins, who was the prosecutor who convicted former Governor George Ryan. So he does have this track record of sniffing out corruption in politics.
As I said, it's Illinois. You know, so I mean, this is to be expected. I mean, you have one side accusing the other side, who's accusing the media, who's using the media to get back at the other side. I mean, this is what happens, and I think the whole issue of endorsing candidates, be it the newspaper, be it a television station, it's old hat. Most people don't pay much attention to it, and it does cause conflict of interest, but it also goes back to, you know, the fact that all these are intermingled. You have one person's married to another person who's mm-hmm. who's involved in politics, who's involved in the media. I mean, it's sort of the microcosm of what's happening in Washington, D.C., plan out at a state in a statewide level or in a local level.
Right. It's insider baseball for one. And it's the dance that all journalists probably have always had in covering politicians is what's my personal bent? Mm-hmm. Who are my relationships built with? And that kind of thing. And the fact that they have to have so much interaction. And there are constantly games of chicken that are being played in terms of I'm going to tell you this and I'm going to figure out whether or not I can trust you with this information. What's off the record? What isn't on the record? Interestingly enough, our political reporter at KNBC in Kansas City always said, I don't take anything off the record. When you talk to me, assume that everything you say, whether it's over a beer, over a smoke, or over a conference table, is on the record.
Well, we have a little bit less than 3 minutes left before our program is up today. And you know what we haven't talked about yet? Ebola. So what do you say we talk about that next quickly before we go? Actually, I want to talk about some decisions that were made at a couple of different journalism schools across the country to cancel speaking engagements with reporters and editors from West African nations. The two biggest schools having gotten attention for having done this are Syracuse University and the Grady School at the University of Georgia that our good friend Charles Davis, who used to be a panelist on this program, where he is now dean. Students seem to have been disappointed in the decision. Administrators are saying it was something that had to be done in order to protect the greater campus community.
Yeah, I think in the situation involving the Grady School down at the University of Georgia, the person that they wanted to invite would have been coming in during that 21-day window that the CDC has set. And they were saying that because of that guideline, they just could not take the chance of doing that. And so in that regard, I think they have a little bit of leeway. The Syracuse one, that's the one that's really causing some conflict because the person had been, the reporter or the photographer and his wife had been working with the CDC and had gone past the 21 days. And they couldn't understand at all, but I think it was a situation where the provost and the president of the university came to the school and said, no, we're not going to do this because we're afraid of what kind of backlash is going to come from parents.
I do understand the decision not to bring someone in who hasn't passed through the 21-day window. I don't after the 21-day window. But generally speaking, this continues to be an issue. The coverage thereof, whether it be journalism schools or journalists, that has become so muddled and so lost in the 24/7 news cycle. And there are such great opportunities to provide clarity, and that has not happened.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for today. We had two other topics we wanted to talk about. I invite people to go to our links blog to find out information about those. You can find it under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan, Pat Akers, and Maya Jackson. And to our associate producers, Kendrisa Cockrell and Hope Kerwin. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.